Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, January 15th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn-Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 832 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, political analyst and professor of comparative literature at the University of Tehran, Mohammad Marandi, joins us to discuss what is happening in Iran and how it relates to Palestine and broader global developments. Later on in the program, John will report on the Qassam Brigade's first official release of names of their fallen soldiers, revealing for the first time their role in the battle in Gaza and the combat videos they produced. But first, let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip, while the Israeli blockade remains firmly in place despite nearly 100 days since the so-called ceasefire was agreed upon in October 2025. On Wednesday, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza announced that since the agreement, at least 450 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,200 have been injured. Also on Wednesday, Hatem Abu Saleh, a nurse, was killed by Israeli occupation forces in Khan Yunis. Reporter Tamer Keshta recorded footage of his family, colleagues, and loved ones grieving over his body, which was taken to the Nasser Medical Complex, where he was a member of the nursing staff. Dr. Mohammed Sakhar, the director of the nursing department where Abu Saleh worked, told TRT World News that Abu Saleh was the target of more than one assassination attempt and had already sustained injuries while on duty inside the hospital complex. He had taken a leave from work to help his family prepare for his son's wedding. But, quote, the occupation's bullets were faster than his chance to attend. Dr. Sakhar added, quote, today we bid farewell to our colleague who never hesitated to serve these afflicted people. The occupation is deliberately targeting medical and nursing staff. We have lost dozens of nurses and doctors in a very short period of time. On Tuesday, January 13th, two Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces in Rafah. The day before, on January 12th, an Israeli quadcopter drone shot and killed three Palestinians in Khan Yunis, identified by the local Wafa news agency as Wissam Abdullah Salem Al-Amur, Mahmoud Subhi Breka, and Atef Samir Al-Bayouk. The attacks came after Israeli army forces carried out airstrikes and shelling across several parts of the enclave on Monday, Al Jazeera noted. Faris Afana, the director of emergency and medical services in Gaza, said this week that Israel continues to violate the ceasefire every single day, leaving civilians under constant fire across Gaza. He reported that four Palestinians were killed on Sunday, January 11th, in Gaza City and other areas, with multiple injuries reported, and that a civilian was shot in the back in Jabalia refugee camp. Afana added that, quote, Israeli occupation snipers are still committing massacres against our Palestinian people. James Elder, the spokesman of the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, who is in Gaza, stated this week while sitting next to the hospital bed of a nine-year-old child that the agency has recorded reports of at least 100 children killed by Israeli attacks and hundreds more wounded during the so-called ceasefire. The child, Abdel Rahman, said he was collecting firewood and plastic when an Israeli missile struck the area he was in, sending a 6-millimeter thick piece of shrapnel into his eye. He says, quote, I want to play with my friends in the neighborhood. They play while I cannot.
I want to watch this video. I don't want to film this video. And certainly little Abdel Rahman wishes he was at home, safe. More than 100 children have been killed in Gaza since the ceasefire of early October. That's roughly one girl or boy killed every day. during a ceasefire. Hundreds, like little Abid al-Rahman, have been wounded. A ceasefire that slows the progress of bombs is progress, but one that still buries Palestinian girls and boys is not enough. This is the moment to turn reduced violence into real safety for children. Open full access for aid, dramatically expand medical evacuations, and turn this into the line where the killing of girls and boys in Gaza finally stops.
That was James Elder of UNICEF. Along with deaths and injuries from bombings, drone strikes, and missile attacks, Israel continues to deprive Palestinians of the right to basic shelter and safe housing, while it weaponizes the winter weather as another instrument of death and misery. Journalist Wissam Shabat filmed the effect of the recent high winds on tent shelters across the beach on Tuesday. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated on Tuesday that hundreds of tents and makeshift shelters were blown away or heavily damaged in brutal wind and rainstorms over the last few days, and that its office has received reports of cases of hypothermia, mainly among children, and people killed as buildings collapse. Reporter Syed Hezbollah filmed a building collapsing in the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of Gaza City on Wednesday evening. The home fell apart, as he says, quote, due to the poor condition of the infrastructure damaged by the war, as well as the heavy rain and strong winds that has hit the Gaza Strip. Israel has refused to allow in necessary materials for infrastructure repairs and maintenance, as well as heavy equipment to clear the vast piles of rubble. And of course, prefabricated caravans and other shelter materials that remain stockpiled on the other side of the Gaza crossings. On Tuesday, the Palestinian Civil Defense reported that at least three people, including a 15-year-old girl, were killed when a building collapsed in Gaza City. Another person was killed in a separate collapse in the city on the same day, and the health ministry reported that at least one Palestinian died when a building toppled on Wednesday, bringing the number of deaths from such incidents to 25 since the beginning of the winter season. Deaths from hypothermia were also reported across Gaza this week due to Israel's defiance of its obligations to allow in caravans and shelter materials. A one-week-old infant named Mahmoud Al-Aqra was brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah on January 10th. Reporter Samer Al-Boji filmed the baby's older brother, who spoke with harrowing grief about how they called the ambulance after feeling the baby's cold leg. The boy says, quote, "We don't have anything but blankets. We wrapped him with the blankets so he could keep warm. We don't have enough blankets or anything. The covers we had were just shawls, and this is what happened to him." A one-year-old baby, also in Deir al-Balah, died in his displaced family's tent on Tuesday, according to medical sources at the hospital. Two other children had died on Monday night due to the freezing conditions and inadequate shelter, Al Jazeera Arabic reported. The Gaza government media office stated on January 13th that since the start of the genocide, at least 24 Palestinians have died from extreme cold in the forced displacement camps, 21 of whom were children. Meanwhile, because of Israel's ongoing blockade and more than 2 years of bombings to most of the infrastructure, municipal workers are warning that destroyed or degraded sewage and water systems across Gaza could create unprecedented health and environmental crises. Our contributor, Asim Al-Nabi, reporting beside a reservoir for Al-Arabi TV on January 13th, said that, quote, "This is one of the consequences of a long-term catastrophic genocidal war. The basin was originally designed to collect rainwater and recharge the groundwater. Today, it is contaminated with vast amounts of sewage, posing a grave threat to Gaza City's groundwater and creating an environmental crisis that may take years or perhaps decades to resolve." Asim is not only a writer for the Electronic Intifada and a reporter with Al-Arabi TV in Gaza, but he is also the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality. The Gaza government media office stated on January 9th that as the Israeli government continues to renege on its obligations under the October 10th agreement, the Gaza Strip is, quote, facing a slow-motion genocide. According to reports, Israel has only allowed in 43% of the minimum agreed upon quantities of humanitarian aid, which has led to a, quote, continued severe shortage of food, medicine, water, and fuel, and has deepened the catastrophic humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. Even the food items that the occupation allows to enter are mostly of low nutritional value, while the occupation prevents the entry of nutritious and essential food items, confirming that the occupation is deliberately pursuing a systematic policy of starvation and deprivation. Furthermore, the media office said that fuel shipments to the Gaza Strip during the same period have only averaged about 5 trucks per day out of the 50 trucks allocated according to the agreement. This represents a compliance rate of approximately 11%, they say, quote, leaving hospitals, bakeries, and water and sanitation facilities in a state of near paralysis and exacerbating the suffering of the civilian population. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces stormed the Batan al-Hawa neighborhood of Silwan in East Jerusalem on Wednesday, assaulting and beating residents, firing sound bombs and tear gas, causing damage to people's personal belongings inside their homes, and detaining at least one man, according to the Wafa news agency. The attacks follow recent forced expulsions of Palestinian families from their homes in Silwan and the imminent expulsion of approximately 24 more families, which are part of a broader effort to expel some 2,200 Palestinians from Silwan, Middle East Eye said. As we reported last week, Israeli forces expelled families from their homes in Silwan and turned the buildings over to an extremist Jewish Israeli settler organization. Also in East Jerusalem, Israeli forces ordered the month-long closure of a health clinic in the Old City and threatened to cut water and electricity if it reopens and provides care for patients. The Al-Zawiya Clinic, which is the oldest clinic run by UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, has, since 1949, provided essential services including pediatric and maternal care. It serves 30,000 people. The clinic offers family planning services, mental health care, treatment for chronic diseases such as hypertension and diabetes, an emergency department, and dental care, according to Wafa, which notes that family planning, childhood vaccinations, and mental health services are available to both refugees and non-refugees. These moves are part of a wide escalation of attacks by Israel on the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees and the people it serves. Roland Friedrich, the director of UNRWA's affairs in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, stated on January 13th that, quote, in a disgraceful move, Israeli security personnel forcibly entered the UNRWA Jerusalem Health Center, demanding the removal of UN signage. The Jerusalem Health Center has been supported over decades by member states, many of whom have visited the premises. Later on the same day, a temporary closure order was issued against the health center, closing it for the next 30 days. It may never open again, he said. The developments, he said, quote, follow the December 2025 amendments made to the anti-UNRWA Knesset laws. These shameful tactics are part of the relentless campaign by Israeli authorities to unilaterally prevent UNRWA from executing its UN General Assembly mandate in occupied East Jerusalem, which does not fall under Israeli sovereignty. The application of Israeli law therein is illegal, he said. Israeli forces raided a Palestinian wedding in Jerusalem on January 9th, firing live ammunition and stun grenades at attendees. Several men were arrested, including the groom, with footage showing soldiers inside the hall and security forces throwing stun grenades as guests were forced outside, Al Jazeera reported. In the southern occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot a 58-year-old man, Shakir Falah al-Jabari, on Saturday, January 10th, as he was inside his vehicle in the eastern part of the city of Al-Khalil, or Hebron. Al-Jabari died from his wounds on Sunday morning, according to reports. The Israeli army said its forces opened fire at a vehicle that accelerated towards soldiers. However, in a later statement, the military acknowledged that an initial review found no evidence that the incident was an intentional attack. Israeli authorities confiscated his body following the shooting, the Wafa news agency reported. The Palestine Red Crescent Society told Al Jazeera that its crew was prevented from reaching the man. The killing came as Israeli forces besieged a house in the old city of Nablus on Sunday, with undercover units infiltrating neighborhoods before military vehicles stormed the city from multiple directions, Al Jazeera noted. Two Palestinians were arrested as troops deployed across several areas and live gunfire echoed through the Eastern Market, according to Palestinian security sources cited by Wafa News Agency. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada this week, but we wanted to highlight Fate of Gaza's Disappeared Remains Unknown by our colleague, the newest addition to our staff, the brilliant reporter, our assistant editor, Khaled Al-Hissi. On October 19th, 2025, Gaza's Ministry of Health announced it had received 150 bodies from Israel, Khaled writes. The corpses were handed over by the International Committee of the Red Cross, and their return followed the ceasefire agreement that came into effect on October 10th, with at least 8,000 people still missing in Gaza, presumed either buried under rubble in mass graves dug by the Israeli military or detained by Israel and held outside Gaza. Determining the fate of the missing is a top priority. But as Israel still keeps crossings into Gaza shut to all but the bare minimum of aid, Gaza's authorities are without heavy machinery to shift millions of tons of rubble or relevant scientific materials to properly identify sometimes deeply decomposed corpses. This undermines the effort to provide information to families of the disappeared. It was left to the forensic teams at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis to examine and document the corpses that were returned in October. The bodies were bound from the hands and ankles and had abrasions and bruises all over, Ahmed Diyar, director of the Forensic Medicine Department in Gaza, said in an October 20th interview with Palestine TV. Some bodies were naked except for their underwear. Others were fully naked, he said. Diyar added that the bodies had all been frozen, preventing the forensic teams from performing autopsies until the tissues thawed after 2 days. Two bodies, he added, had been blindfolded and had constraints around their necks. Others bore signs of physical abuse. Several bodies had gunshot wounds to the head and chest, he said, suggesting that they may have been executed. Some were just skeletons, while others were in an advanced state of decomposition. The Israeli side provided 90 DNA profiles along with the 150 bodies, but no names. Yet the Gaza Strip, as Israel is well aware, lacks equipment and tools for DNA or tissue analysis. We only have a rudimentary procedure relying on the body's length, trying to specify the age, the nutritional status, the presence of personal belongings from the teeth, the bones, previous surgeries or amputations, distinguishing marks on the body like scars or moles in distinctive locations only the family can recognize, Diyar said. Providing DNA profiles is futile as a result, he said. Based on the October so-called ceasefire agreement, Israel was to hand over bodies according to a 15-to-1 ratio, 15 Palestinians for every Israeli. As of January 2026, the Ministry of Health in Gaza had received 345 bodies, from which, so far, only 99 have been identified. DR explained the process of identifying these bodies in a video published by Gaza's Ministry of Health on October 14th. Forensic teams examined the bodies to determine the cause of death, how long since death, and the types of injuries suffered. A criminal evidence team then documents and photographs these injuries along with the body's general features and clothing. These photos are uploaded. Please be warned, the pictures are harrowing. To a website created by the Ministry of Health in Gaza, where people can view the photos to try to identify the corpses. If someone recognizes a body, they head to Nasser Medical Complex to view the photos again. After confirming that it is the right body and that they have a close relationship or are relatives, they are allowed to take the body for burial. If a corpse is not identified, it will be buried in a designated location where every grave is numbered, a mass grave for unidentified martyrs. In case someone later identifies a body from photos, they will know where their loved one was buried. Those are excerpts from Fate of Gaza's Disappeared Remains Unknown by our colleague Khaled El-Hissi on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. In the Sawarha displacement camp in central Gaza, an animal therapy expert brought two rescued puppies to play with children. The Samir Project, a local mutual aid group which supports the camp and its residents, says, quote, "Animals bring happiness and purpose. They do not judge. They love unconditionally. This is so important, particularly at our medical camps, where we rehabilitate those with injuries and care for the sick. Our two new puppies will bring happiness amidst the pain." That's from the Samir Project in Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. How are you?
Hanging in. How are you?
The same. You know, I'm in Amman in Jordan, and for the sun came out today, but for the last few days it has been constant heavy rain and extremely cold. And normally all that rain is something that is seen as a blessing, but I just have not been able to stop thinking of people trying to survive that in Gaza with no sources of heat, no shelter, no electricity, inadequate clothing. I just don't think that it's something easy to overlook how much misery and suffering and death that is causing. We know that people are dying of exposure in Gaza. So this genocide continues, not just with bombs. And that's something that's really been on my mind.
They're weaponizing the weather. They know exactly what they're doing. They're bragging about it, and no one is stopping them. It's so miserable. We have an incredible show today. Let's go to our segment with Dr. Mohamed Marandi. Why don't you introduce the segment, and then we'll go to it.
Thanks, Nora. You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abunima, here with my colleague Nora Barrows-Friedman. In cities across Iran in recent days, millions of people have marched in support of their government and to protest violence that foreign intelligence agencies have been instigating in the latest Western push for regime change. Israel's Mossad spying and assassination agency has actually been boasting publicly about its role. On Wednesday, enormous crowds turned out again in the capital, Tehran, for a mass funeral of some 100 police and security officers killed in attacks by foreign-backed insurgents. Western media and politicians paint a totally opposite picture, portraying a regime in crisis, wantonly killing its own people to crush a mass uprising seeking its overthrow. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump has been escalating his threats of renewed U.S. military attacks on Iran, raising the risk of another U.S.-Israeli instigated regional war. And while Western governments pretend to be concerned for Iran's people, they continue to aid and abet Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. On Wednesday evening, President Trump appeared to turn down the temperature slightly, asserting that Iran had halted its deadly crackdown, thus potentially giving himself a way out of the escalation that he has caused. We've been told, Trump said, that the killing in Iran is stopping and there's no plan for executions. We're going to watch and see, he added. In an interview recorded on Wednesday evening, Tehran time, hours before Trump's apparently de-escalatory statements, our guest Mohammed Marandi said that there is a good chance of war. Let's go to that interview now. Now from Tehran by Dr. Mohammed Marandi. He's a professor of comparative literature at the University of Tehran and a renowned geopolitical analyst. Thank you for joining us again on the Electronic Intifada live stream, Dr. Marandi.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always an honor.
So we're recording this interview on Wednesday evening, Tehran time. And I want to start by reading you the opening paragraphs of a story that appeared in the New York Times on Tuesday. The headline is "Shoot to Kill: Accounts of Brutal Crackdown Emerge from Iran." And the subheadline is "As many as 3,000 feared dead as witnesses describe government forces firing on unarmed protesters." Here's how that story begins. As the Iranian authorities impose a near-total communication blackout on a country convulsed by mass protests, videos and witness accounts slowly emerging suggest that the government is waging one of its deadliest crackdowns in more than a decade. Eyewitnesses say government forces have begun opening fire, apparently with automatic weapons, and at times seemingly indiscriminately on unarmed protesters. Hospital workers say protesters had been coming in with pellet injuries, but now arrive with gunshot wounds and skull fractures. One doctor called it a mass casualty situation. Despite the communications blockade, a recurring image has made its way out of Iran. Rows and rows of body bags. In videos uploaded by opposition activists on social media, families can be seen sobbing as they huddle together over bloodied corpses in unzipped bags. And in footage aired on Iranian state television, a morgue official sheathed in blue scrubs stands amid bags neatly arranged on the floor of a white room under glaring fluorescent lights. And I'm skipping a bit now, but just a few more sentences from this New York Times article. They say, "The toll of dead and injured across the country is unclear. Human rights groups are struggling to reach their contacts inside Iran and follow the methodology they normally use to verify information, but say they have counted more than 500 dead. Multiple American officials say that U.S. intelligence agencies have conservatively estimated that more than 600 protesters have been killed so far. The agencies have noted that both the current protests and the crackdown are far more violent than those in 2022 or other recent uprisings against the government. A senior Iranian health ministry official speaking on condition of anonymity said about 3,000 people had been killed across the country, but sought to shift the blame to quote-unquote terrorists fomenting unrest. That the figure included hundreds of security officers," he said. So, Dr. Marandi, that's an excerpt from the New York Times, but it is typical of coverage across Western media. And now we're even seeing claims from CBS, the American news network run by Israel propagandist Barry Weiss, that the death toll may be higher than 12,000. We're also seeing countless statements from Western governments condemning Iran in the strongest terms and threatening even more sanctions. This is the picture that is being uniformly presented of the situation in Iran as the media talk about possible U.S. military intervention. What's your response to all this, and how do you see the situation in and from Tehran?
Well, did the New York Times add anything about the rapes on October the 7th? I mean, I think that could have been a part of this article. It's about as credible as their claims back then. The New York Times, first of all, or Reuters in particular, because Reuters began this whole thing about anonymous Iranian officials gave these numbers of deaths. Reuters has a history of lying. Whenever they have unnamed officials, they're lying. And I have personal experience because during the nuclear negotiations, Reuters was constantly quoting officials of and saying things that were not true because I knew they were not true because I was involved. I was the media advisor to the team. What I can say, Ali, is that I was on Piers Morgan yesterday, and it was a very it's a very bizarre show, and I only went because George Galloway said you should go, so I went. And but on the show, I put footage. I gave them footage to show. I said, I want you to show this footage, and it was helicopter footage of Monday's mass rallies in support of the state, in support of the Constitution, in support of the leader, and against the riots. And it was across the country. Every city had its own. And the one in Tehran was massive. Pierce brought this crazy woman who threatened to kill me and cut my body into small pieces. Anyway, he brought her, and she was saying, this is fake. And Pierce Morgan wanted to say, this is fake. So this is AI, and all these millions of people on the streets across the country in Iran, they're AI. And so, but even though...
Now, you attended or you witnessed those rallies on Monday yourself in Tehran?
Yes, yes, I was there. In fact, I entered, for those who may know a thing or two about Tehran, or they could use AI, I entered from... Hafez Street, and I went to the Valley Ass crossing, and I couldn't go further because I was stuck, and I got worried that it was just too big of a crowd, and it went all the way to Imam Hussein Square, and my relatives near Azadi Square said the crowd went there, and a couple of friends of mine. I know you don't know these names, but from Enghilab Square south to Imam Khomeini Square, he was on that route, and it was full. So the east-west street, I guess, is 10 kilometers because it has bridges and undergrounds. So, and then the north-south, I don't know how many kilometers it is, full of people. And when I was leaving, when it was over, people were still trying to get there because they were stuck in traffic. It took hours to get there and to get back. And imagine all those people who are like working class people who have difficulty.
That hopeful note, knowing that anything can happen at any moment.
All they had to do is call them to the streets, and these people would have run away. The first day, what happened, Ali? Let me put it this way. The first day, we had a sudden fall in the currency. And that was because the Americans were manipulating the markets from abroad in neighboring countries. And that's why people think that this was all a part of the plan. After the currency fell, shop owners and business people, like a few thousand, a couple, here and there in different cities, combined a few thousand, went to the streets and protested to the central bank. For good reason, because they were saying we sell our goods and then the goods that we have to buy with the profit are now more expensive and we can't do it and it'll run out, we'll go bankrupt. There are no arrests. There is no police brutality like you see in Germany when someone is wearing a keffiyeh. There are no policemen battering people or taking them to jail because they had a placard like an 80-year-old Jewish woman in London saying no to genocide. And she has to go to jail. Nothing happened. And then I think basically from day three-ish, I'm not good at days, but Maria has never been very good. But on day three, these rioters came in. Now, Pompeo, the former head of the CIA, said that in his tweet that Mossad is on the ground.
Yeah, Just to put that, to give people exactly what that was. This was on January 2nd. Former U.S. Secretary of State and CIA Director Mike Pompeo tweeted, quote, "Happy New Year to every Iranian in the streets, also to every Mossad agent walking beside them."
They're not even trying to hide it anymore, really.
No.
Yeah. So that's what
by the way, Nora, yeah. This is all about Palestine. I mean, the authoritarian regimes that the West talked about, though all the authoritarian regimes that have no elections are U.S. allies. But Iran, which has elections, which has, you know, the, one day they're saying this is a reformist president, the next day the other. You know, so there's diversity in Iran. But Iran is evil and sinister because it opposes the genocide. So Pompeo says that Mossad is there. The Mossad says that they are there because they put out a Persian language statement. And I think the Jerusalem Post also said something about this, saying that they're on the ground. And then I think just yesterday, Channel 14 of Israel, the Israeli regime, said that foreign countries are giving weapons. Now, they are saying it, and then Western pundits are saying, no, they're all peaceful protesters. So the guilty party is saying, I did it. And then their entourage is saying, no, they're not doing it. It's all peaceful protests. In fact, I read this person, I don't want to name him. He did a tweet and was saying what Channel 14 of Israel, when they admitted that foreign governments are sending in weapons, what Channel 14 is doing is it's undermining the sort of peaceful protest narrative. Well, yeah, of course, because there were peaceful protests and nothing happened to them. Then the rioters came in. And then Ali, we had 100 officers of the law roughly who were murdered, 300 to 400 with the Basij, with the riot police, and with the guards, let's say, all of them. It's 300 or so. Some say up to 400. Some say, no, it's closer to 300. Let's stick to 300. Today, 100 people, they had a mass funeral in Tehran. These were the martyrs. In the United States, a woman is driving her car. She's turning to the right. She gets shot in the face. And then the argument is, and the divide over in the United States is, whether she turned enough to the right to make the shot in the face unacceptable, or whether she didn't turn enough to the right and she deserved to get shot in the face. So when this is the debate in the United States and the U.S. president is supporting the ICE officer who murdered her and shot her three times, then the United States and the elites in the United States are in no position to talk about rioters who killed 300 to 400, but let's say 300 officers of the law, Basij, riot police, and guards. That's a fact. In the United States, if they kill one police officer, what happened? They killed hundreds. And then they call this peaceful protest? And if they were killing people, why didn't they kill the peaceful protesters on day one and two? And the whole time, a TV channel called Iran International, and also BBC Persian, but Iran International in particular, which is funded by Western agents, intelligence agencies, they were saying, they were advocating armed violence. And I tweeted a clip of one of their presenters saying this. Is Ofcom in the UK going to do anything about it? Of course not, because that's their policy. So you can kill people in Iran, you can bomb the country, you can send in terrorists, you can openly advocate terrorism, and then the media will deny all of it. Just like with Gaza.
Right.
No one should be surprised. If anyone is surprised by now that maybe the Western narrative is not correct, and that person has been in a coma for the last couple of years. It's obvious after Gaza, if anyone believes Western narratives, I mean, let me put it this way, Ali. 2.3 to 3 million people went to the streets in Tehran on Monday. Whether the West likes it or not, that's a fact. Anyone can go to the live stream of Press TV and watch it. They have hours of it. And then in other cities too, whatever the numbers, huge numbers of people went to the streets, right? So when you have all these, this huge crowd going to the street, that means they support the state. That means they support the constitution. despite the fact that we have an Persian language media empire in the West. There's nothing like it in the world. Not against China, not against Russia, not against anyone. You have maybe hundreds of TV channels, but a few of them big, beaming in anti-Iranian information, outgunning Iranian media by far. You have all sorts of Telegram channels and Twitter accounts with big followings. And then you have thousands of people who work 24 hours a day, literally in shifts in camps like Albania. They're online foot soldiers and the bots and all that. 24 hours a day, every day, 365 days a year, anti-Iranian propaganda is being beamed into Iran. So the Iranians hear everything. They hear all the anti-Iranian information, misinformation, twisted truths, lies, and all that. They outgun the Iranian media. So I'm supposed to believe that all these millions of people that went on the streets in Mashhad, in Esfahan, in Tabriz, in Marand, in Shiraz, in Ahvaz, in Kerman, in Zahedan, all these people, they say, yeah, they killed thousands of people on the streets and gunned them down, but we're still going to go to the streets and support them?
Piers Morgan would say, wouldn't he, that, you know, Iran is an authoritarian dictatorship and those people are forced out into the streets.
Of course. But, you know, the Iranian regime, as they like to call it, the Iranian regime, if it's so competent that in the middle of this mass uprising, it can bring millions of people to the streets, then they're quite competent and they deserve to be in power. But none of this makes sense. The only reason why it makes sense to these pundits in the West and these so-called Iran experts and the media is that it's negative. Anything bad about Iran makes sense, even if it's contradictory. Like when they say Iran is collapsing, it's falling apart, it's despised, it's corrupt, but it's a growing menace, it's a threat to the region, it's a threat to the world. How can it be both things at the same time? Why? Even though it can't, but they believe both because both are bad. They say, oh, it's negative. And here's the case too. Iran can bring millions of people to the streets. Well, it's an authoritarian regime. Well, how come the authoritarian regime cannot control an uprising? None of this makes sense, but it's not supposed to, because it plays on the emotions of ordinary people. The same people who one day were saying we shouldn't get involved in Venezuela, and then the next day say they're saying, you know, we're number one. You know, they play upon the emotions of different groups in American society, and they're fooled. So right now, there's a huge, I mean, whether it's AOC or Trump, they're all saying the same thing. It's really interesting. Everyone is on the same page. We have to save the Iranian people. Well, if you want to help the Iranian people, the first thing you can do is end the sanctions. When Trump said, I want to increase the tariffs, that's to hurt the Iranian people. So, you know, they want to strangle the Iranian economy, just like they did with Venezuela, just like they did with Cuba, and they do with these countries. And then they say they're the friends of Iran. They're trying to kill Iranians. When you impose sanctions, you get shortages of medicine. Then because the economy doesn't grow, the currency goes down, the price of medicine goes up. And since people lose jobs, they cannot buy medicine. Or people lose their jobs, they can't make money, that causes families to break up, or, you know, all sorts of harm. The objective is to tear apart the fabric of society so that people become so desperate that they will rise up in desperation. That is the objective. That's war, and it's targeting ordinary people. So for Westerners in the media, Western media, I don't mean like the young people and those who are supporting the Palestinians and all that, and, you know, but, you know, these people who speak about human rights, they're all the enemies of human rights, every single one of them, because what the United States is doing to Iran is trying to make it suffer, and so are the Europeans. I mean, the German chancellor said apparently a couple of days ago, I'm in the studio, I'm at Press TV, and I don't have internet at home. When I'm here, I try to catch up with the news. But I don't know exactly what he said, but apparently he said something that, like, the Iranian regime or something is not legitimate or something like that. I mean, he is the guy that when the Israelis started bombing Iran, he said they do our dirty work for us.
And yesterday, I don't know how much you've been following the news. The German interior minister went to Israel and met with Netanyahu, a war criminal wanted by the International Criminal Court. So, I mean, it's just extraordinary. It's almost laughable. The double standards. Go ahead, Nora.
But we talked about Mike Pompeo's comments about every Mossad agent walking beside every Iranian in the street. Mossad, of course, is Israel's notorious spying and assassination agency. And on Tuesday, Donald Trump published a post on his Truth Social website stating, quote, "Iranian patriots, keep protesting, take over your institutions," with 3 exclamation points. "Save the names of the killers and abusers. They will pay a big price." And he added, "I have canceled all meetings with Iranian officials until the senseless killing of protesters stops. Help is on its way. MEGA, make Iran great again." Dr. Mirandi, how do you think the Iranian public and government understand those statements? And are there people in Iran who want American military intervention or regime change to, bring democracy to the people of Iran or make Iran great again?
Do you want to be bombed into freedom is the question.
Well, I've never tried it before, so I can't say with certainty if I like being bombed into freedom. I'm speculating that it's probably not a good idea based on what I've heard here and there. But the fact is that, and this is another thing that people in the United States have to appreciate. People in Iran see that Mossad is involved. People in Iran know that Pompeo has admitted this. It's in the news here. And does anyone in their right mind in the West think that the popular opinion in Iran supports the Mossad and their involvement in Iran? They support CIA involvement in Iran. They support the threat of strikes and attack against Iran? Yes, of course there's a small minority that's pro-Western. There's a small minority that's pro-Israel. You will find people in Iran that support Israel. Racists, usually, like these people who hate Arabs. They're a disgusting few. I have a student who had an argument with me over this last semester, or someone at Press TV actually, has this disgusting view. But overwhelmingly, people despise the Israeli regime. And the reason why they came to the streets in such extraordinary numbers is because a lot of people who usually don't even go to the streets, they just mind their own business, say, no, here I have to go. I have to take part in this anti-riot, anti-Western interference demonstration. But the belief in Tehran, or at least the belief among many, is that this whole episode was to bring us to war. The Americans manipulated the currency, sparking protests, and these groups that were pre-prepared infiltrated and then caused riots and violence. And a lot of people died, including a lot of innocent people who were just going to work or coming home from work. And then the Americans can be pushed to war. And you see everyone now, as I said, from AOC to Levin, all of them are saying, we have to help the Iranian people. the genocide in Gaza, none of them said that. The ongoing genocide in Gaza. So this is the real truth. And if the United States attacks Iran, they will be hit very hard, and they should not expect Iran to hit American bases or to hit Israel. It will be far broader than that. So Trump should be very careful, because if this is a very sensitive region and a lot of oil and gas go through the Strait of Hormuz, and the Persian Gulf is not very wide, and the oil and gas fields export from Iraq. Iraq is, most of the MPs in Iraq are close to Iran.
If the United States attacks,
you could see a lot.
Yeah, allow me to interrupt you. I apologize. I know what you're going to say. I've heard you say it before.
Sure.
That the Strait of Hormuz is very narrow. You don't need big long-range ballistic missiles. We're talking about a distance of dozens of kilometers, maybe hundreds of kilometers at the most, and Iran has thousands of missiles, perhaps. I don't know that I know or you know. The so-called intelligence services of the West issue estimates, not facts. So all of that may be the case. In June, last June, Israel, with the full backing of the United States, launched a massive war on Iran, decapitation strikes, killing many senior military leaders. And Iran fired back missiles. We spoke to you at that time. Now, what I want to say to you is that Iran has carried out True Promise 1, True Promise 2, True Promise 3. That didn't deter Israel or the United States. They're coming back again. I read, maybe it was in the Washington Post or the New York Times, one of them, can't remember, doesn't really matter, that Iran has only a third of the missile launchers that it had in June. So I put it to you, Dr. Mirandi, that there's a lot of bluster and hot air. What do you say to that? I'm doing my Piers Morgan impression here for you.
Oh, yeah. What I would say is that Iran today is significantly more prepared than it was 7 months ago. And it has learned a lot from the 12-day war. Remember, Iran hadn't fought a war. The Israeli regime and the Americans have been, they're always in war. But Iran had not fought a war since Saddam Hussein, with Western backing, invaded the country decades ago. This was the first time. And so Iran understood its shortcomings and its strengths. And it's been preparing itself ever since. And it's been putting a lot of effort in this. And there's another thing, Ali, that's important. During the 12-day war, Iran focused on the Israeli regime. The Americans struck Iran once. What damage was done? Debatable. If any significant damage was done at all. But I don't want to go there. The Iranians struck back at Doha. 6 missiles struck, destroyed sensitive buildings that belong to the United States in Qatar. But the focus was on Israel. Iran did not want to expand the war. They wanted to put Israel in its place. And ultimately, it was the Israelis that sought a ceasefire. Steve Bannon, the day after the war, went and said that the real story here is that Israel was in bad trouble during the last few days, and they needed a ceasefire, and they're begging for a ceasefire, and Trump helped get them one. A war with the United States would be a totally different war. Iran's real capabilities are not directed toward Israel. Iran's real capabilities are directed towards the Persian Gulf. Why? Because for decades, the United States has been threatening Iran with war. They invaded Afghanistan, then they took Iraq. They were it was a unipolar moment. They were in Central Asia. Iran was surrounded. So they were building underground bases with short-range missiles, medium-range missiles, which are much more maneuverable and easy to move around, short-range, medium-range drones, to destroy assets across the Persian Gulf, their navy, their underwater drones. They've been preparing themselves for war with the United States. War with the Israeli regime has always been a sideshow. So these long-range missiles that hit the Israelis are a small part of the Iranian arsenal. And Iran has more missiles than it had back then, and it didn't use by far. I mean, it only used a small proportion of its missiles, and a few launchers were destroyed. But there's footage of Iranian underground bases where you see launcher after launcher after launcher after launcher. It's that's wishful thinking on their behalf, just like everything about Iran. Ali, for ever since I was a teenager, Iran is on the verge of collapse. 16 years ago, what's his name? I just forgot his name. The CNN pundit, Farid Zakaria, told me that you are a mouthpiece for a dying regime. It's been 16 years, and this dying regime won't die. And I don't expect it to die during my lifetime, but I think the U.S. empire is going to die probably in a much shorter period of time than the likes of Farid Zakaria think. So the problem with the United States is that they like to underestimate Iran because of their own supremacist worldview. And I'm talking about the elites, you know, this American exceptionalism. I'm not talking about ordinary Americans, because we've discussed this numerous times before in your show. You have, you know, younger generation. I mean, I don't have any opinion about the mayor of New York, but young Jews in the United States, the majority of them, as far as I understand, voted for him. And young people across the United States, their views on Israel are clear. So I'm not talking about, when I say Americans, I'm talking about the political regime. I'm not talking about ordinary people. So no one should be offended. But the regime in Washington is supremacist, like Israel. It sees itself as, and, you know, like I think Madeleine Albright once said, we see far further and than others, or something like that, you know, as if like we are different. We are exceptional. And because of that, they're always looking down at others. And of course, at the bottom, you know, the worst of the worst is always Iran. But if they go forward with that sort of calculation, they're going to be hurt. They thought in the 12-day war that Iran would collapse, that Iran would fall. Remember when Trump tweeted total surrender, or absolute surrender, or something like that? Well, what happened?
Unconditional surrender, yeah.
Unconditional surrender, exactly. Well, what happened? Ultimately, it was Netanyahu who sought a ceasefire. It wasn't Iran. Iran was not communicating with anyone asking for a ceasefire. It was willing to go on. In fact, and this is not a secret, but it is not widely known because it's not talked about abroad, but Iran was about to fire a huge volley of missiles towards the Israeli regime because the Israelis they'd almost finished their air defenses. And if the war had continued like 2 or 3 extra days, you would have seen a big and unprecedented strike on different targets in Israel with very old missiles, older generation missiles. But in any case, the point is that the smart thing to do for the American people is to not buy this nonsense. Iran is anyone can go and look at the live stream of Monday. The state has popular support, and no one welcomes invasion or attacks. And the Persian Gulf is a very sensitive place, and I don't think anyone. Trump just yesterday, I think, said he wants oil at $53 a barrel. Well, we'll see what happens if there's war. I think that oil can easily go up to $300 a barrel if it's all out war.
Dr. Mirendi, if you can put the current events in a broader regional and global context, you know, after the June war, the 12-day war, which killed more than 1,000 people in Iran, including many children, which, you know, it was, as you were mentioning, a failed regime change effort, is what we're seeing now a continuation of that war? But also, how does what is happening right now in Iran, how does that relate to the recent U.S. aggression against Venezuela? You know, the efforts to, you know, pull another regime change operation there, the kidnapping of its president, of course, Nicolas Maduro, and First Lady Celia Flores. How does it relate to Iran's support for the Palestinian liberation struggle, particularly the resistance in Gaza?
Nora, this whole antagonism towards Iran is about Palestine. If Iran was like Turkey, and I mean the government, if it was like Saudi Arabia, if it was like Emirates, or any of these countries, there would be no sanctions and all would be well, and Iran wouldn't be a regime. You know, you don't hear them say the Jordanian regime or the Egyptian regime or the Saudi regime or the Turkish regime. These are all.
And you notice that Syria has gone in the Western press from being a regime to a government now.
Yes, of course, because now a democracy has been brought to Syria and Al-Qaeda. It's stunning, and this shows how easily Americans, and again, I'm not saying all Americans, how easily they're manipulated. 9/11, I mean, they said the world has changed, but a decade later, they were working with Al-Qaeda, the same Al-Qaeda, as they say, in Libya and then in Syria, and now they brought the head of Al-Qaeda to power, and Trump supports him, meets him, sprays perfume on him. It's quite stunning. But you don't see mass protests in the United States because it's sort of like, I don't know, it's like the American people, it's really okay. I'm not saying it's okay, but I think most Americans are, or at least a large segment of American society, they're so deeply propagandized that they just don't know what's going on. I'm pretty sure that Americans don't even, many Americans don't know where Venezuela is or where Iran is or where Syria is. So yes, so Maduro has killed millions of people, according to Trump, and he's a bad guy. But the head of Syria, Jolani, who was a co-founder of ISIS and the leader of Al-Qaeda in Syria, he's a good guy. That's how it works. And in this upside down world of Western morality, obviously Iran is going to be the bad guy. So Iranians recognize that they are paying the price for supporting the people of Palestine. But to the great enormous credit of the Iranian people, they don't give, even though Iranians, you know, Ali, Nora, one of the interesting things is Iranians know that Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey under Erdogan and these other oil and gas rich regimes, they fund sectarianism through their mosques that they fund, through their cultural centers, through their media, and they have hundreds of channels and all. I mean, it's not just Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya. These are like the big names, but they have all sorts. And Iranians also know that even among Palestinians, they've created through disinformation and misinformation and twisting reality, they've made them, some Palestinians, dislike Iran and the Shia. And this Persian language empire, media empire, which I told you about, constantly reminds people that this Palestinian person, he said this about the Shia, about Iran, about Hezbollah. And despite that, the Iranians look beyond it. And they continue. And if you look at polls, the Iranians have overwhelming support for the Palestinian people. It doesn't matter.
I think And I think, if I may, you talked about this Persian language media empire beaming all this propaganda into Iran. And, you know, I see it peripherally. I don't know Farsi. I would love to learn it. You see it. I mean, even in my social media feed, I'm being bombarded with this propaganda as well. You know, mirroring that, there has been an Arabic language propaganda apparatus, huge one, working for decades to propagandize Arabs against Iran and to teach them that Iran is their enemy, that the Shia are their enemy, that the Shia are heretics, even though historically this is, you know, completely baseless. And I have to say, you do see that reflected among some Arabs. I mean, I'm often shocked by the racism I hear from Arabs against Iranian people and the sectarianism I hear. But I have to say that, you know, again, this is my perspective. Just as you say that anti-Arab racism in Iran is quite marginal, I think that the anti-Iranian or anti-Persian or anti-Shia racism and sectarianism is also marginal among Arabs, and at least from my perspective. And I think that is because there is this now much greater understanding of what is at stake in all this, in the sense that countries are targeted because of their stance vis-a-vis the Palestinian struggle and Israel. And it's also not a coincidence, I think, that Venezuela, aside from all the other reasons why the United States is hostile to Venezuela, you know, the United States has never allowed any country in the Western Hemisphere to exercise sovereignty and independence. But aside from that, I think it's not a coincidence that Venezuela has taken a very strong stance in solidarity with Palestinians, and that Hugo Chavez, the late president and the founder of this revolutionary movement that rules Venezuela now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It comes down, is it that it just comes down to geopolitics and people's eyes are being open to that? From my perspective, and maybe that's a slightly optimistic note to kind of draw a discussion to a close, but do you think that there are reasons for optimism now as we're speaking, Dr. Mirandi? Are we on the eve of a devastating war, or do you see signs of glimmers of hope or optimism? And how can we encourage the strands of hope and optimism from our limited means and perspectives?
Well, there's a very good chance that there will be war, and Iran is preparing for a major war. But and that would be, you know, catastrophic for the world. But at the same time, that doesn't make me pessimistic in the broader sense, because you're absolutely correct. Despite this massive media network in the West, this Persian anti-Iranian media network that's anti-Islamic Republic of Iran, but also anti-Arab, and this well-funded media network through oil and gas money and NATO countries that tell Arabs that this divide and rule is sort of beginning to melt away, because people are seeing through the propaganda, and the Western Empire is on the decline. And the same is true in Venezuela. One of the really fascinating things, Annie, is that I've been to Venezuela, I think, four times. And each time, because it's so far away, I spent a few days, because going back and forth is not easy. Venezuelans are very friendly to Iranians, and the relationship is excellent. So the issue is not religion. The issue is not sect. The issue is not race. It is the empire versus the rest of the world. The rest of the world wants to live in peace, and they want growth, and they want sovereignty, and they want dignity. And they have excellent relations with each other. and or they want to have excellent relations with each other. And it is the West that wants to keep everyone divided. So, of course, they are the ones who benefit from sectarianism. And their tools in the region fund that sectarianism and promote that sectarianism because they're in the American camp. But it's not working like it did before. If, God forbid, there's a war between Iran and the United States, it will be devastating. But it will be the end, or at least it will bring down the empire much faster than before. It will cause great harm, but the Iranians will not lose this war. Without a doubt, it will be the U.S. government. And when that happens, I think a lot of people will be seeking Donald Trump and all those people who advocated this war and saying, you've ruined the economy, you've ruined our lives. But all that aside, the good news is that just like in the United States and the West, young people are waking up. Across the world, people are waking up. They see the ugliness of the American empire. And that's one of the, how can I put it? That's one of the things about Trump that's actually helpful, because he says the quiet part out loud. You know, Biden started the genocide with Netanyahu. Obama was constantly using drones to murder people across the world. He destroyed Libya. He started the dirty war in Syria. He gave Saudi Arabia and the Emirates the green light to destroy Yemen and to carry out a genocidal war. All the previous presidents were more or less the same. This is an empire. But Trump is so crude, and simultaneously the United States is on the decline, that it's becoming apparent and clear for everyone, or at least most people, what's going on, whether inside the United States, whether across the West, or beyond the West. People across Latin America, when they hear Trump say, the oil is mine, does anyone think that people in even in right-wing countries like Argentina appreciate that, that they like that, or they feel threatened by it, or they feel insulted by it? What Trump is doing, the language that he uses, the behavior that he has, the policies that he pursues, Greenland and, you know, the trade wars and the continuation of the CIA support for the proxy war in Ukraine, none of this is going to, all of this is hurting the United States. And it's clear to everyone what's happening. The hypocrisy is gone. Obama, in that respect, was the best of them all. And Clinton, in his youth, too, they were able to pretend that they cared about democracy, even as they were destroying country after country. And people believed them, or some people, many did. But now people are awake. And so that gives me a lot of hope for the future. Young people, when I see young Americans against the Israeli regime, I could never have imagined this 3-4 years ago in my lifetime. And when I see so many young people, you know, on the streets, and that's what the ceasefire was about, by the way, the fake ceasefire, because they're killing people every day. I mean, that's your expertise, of course, you and Nora and your colleagues, your top, you know, website on all this. So I don't want to go too much into this. But the fake ceasefire, in my opinion, was basically about preventing global public opinion from exploding, because it turned against Israel and the regime. And we saw people in Australia, of all places, and Italy, and across Europe and everywhere protesting in huge numbers. So they needed a respite. But the world has changed, and I'm optimistic. I think there's a good chance of war. I don't know if it'll be a major war or a minor attack or no attack. I don't know, because Trump is not mentally stable and he's easily persuaded. But the Iranians have prepared themselves for the worst.
Well, Dr. Mehrandi, let's end this discussion on that hopeful note, knowing that anything can happen at any moment. We never know what we're going to wake up to. By the time people are watching this interview, since we pre-recorded it, who knows what the world will look like. But no matter what, we always learn so much from your insight. And we wish you and everyone in Iran peace, tranquility, safety, and justice. And truly, we wish that for everyone on this planet. Dr. Marandi, thank you for your precious time. And we hope always to have the opportunity to listen to you and learn from you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Nora. And thank you. I thank your team for all the fantastic work that you do. You were supporting the Palestinian cause when the numbers were few and awareness was very limited. And you've helped create this environment where young people could learn about the truth and reality, and hopefully gradually they'll learn more about Iran and Hezbollah and Ansarullah, and recognize that these entities, their struggle is to support the oppressed, and the Palestinian people are the most oppressed people in the world today, and they will continue to do so because they have a responsibility and they feel responsible for it. And I think hopefully in the future, more Americans will become more aware about this reality and recognize that the narratives produced by mainstream media on Iran are just as ridiculous as the narratives on Palestine. And in fact, the narratives on Iran are hostile because Iran supports Palestine.
Thank you very much, Dr. Marandi.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow. Yeah, I'm very, very glad that we got that interview yesterday, Ali. And yeah,
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, Dr. Marandi has been doing a lot of interviews, and each one I listen to, I hear something new, I really like hearing his perspective. And of course, this is a perspective we're not hearing in mainstream media. So I think it's important to hear it.
Yeah.
I think we lost a minute. We had a little glitch, maybe a minute or two of the interview early on when he was talking about what he witnessed in terms of the enormous crowds in Tehran on Monday. But of course, we'll have the full interview posted online without that little glitch. It was just a small technical glitch. Yeah. We didn't miss too much, so no. I hope people won't mind that.
Thank you. All right. And of course, we're going to keep an eye on the situation in Iran and the, you know, imperial reaches from here in the belly of the beast, the US and North America and Europe. Let's bring on John in the meantime. Hey, John.
Hello. How's it going? American invasion a week on this show.
Yeah, no kidding.
and who knows? Maybe it will be Greenland next week because, you know, what it is I don't know. It was a week ago that we had that really rich discussion with Justin Poder, focused on Venezuela, also talking about Palestine and broader issues. And now, you know, the mainstream have moved on from Venezuela.
Yeah,
that's like old news.
Not even on the news today.
No. It's not even on the news. But I think part of the reason for that is that it's been a failure. You know, Trump brought in all the big oil companies and told them, you're all going to go to Venezuela and invest. And they all said no. So that's the other thing, is that these U.S. operations don't go to plan. As Justin said, and for those who missed it, if you go to electronicintifada.net, we have the article up summarizing last week's live stream. And the discussion with Justin Poder of the Anti-Empire Project is just so good. But what he said is, you know, the Americans always win day one. Mm-hmm. That phrase is really helpful because they shock and awe people. And that's what it was with Iran, too. The more I look at this and the more I've read and listened to, even since we talked to Dr. Marandi yesterday, I think the game is that, as they did in June, They're trying to light a spark, and their hope is that the Iranian people will rise up and do the regime change for them. It didn't work in June. It doesn't look like it's working now. I don't want to make predictions because we're dealing, as Dr. Meredith said, with a very unstable decision maker in the United States.
I'll say.
But yeah. But you know, it didn't happen. You know, they did this thing. But it didn't light off this revolution that they wanted, even though a lot of blood has been spilled in Iran again. I mean, you'll also recall a few weeks back when we spoke with filmmaker Leila Al-Aryan, who did that amazing documentary, that episode of Fault Lines for Al Jazeera English, looking at the human cost in Iran. You know, 1,000 people killed, children killed in their own homes, children maimed, and that's true now. You know, there are people being killed in Iran, but I don't think any Iranians, or the vast majority of Iranians, want that. Nobody wants that in their own country. They want to live in peace.
And the way that it's just been so propagandized, you know, as Mirandi was saying, there's, you know, hundreds of foreign broadcasters and publications and websites dedicated to you know, fomenting a different narrative for Iranians, either in Iran or outside the country. And you know, this whole manufacturing of consent for yet another war of aggression, you know, as a so-called color revolution, is always something to keep in mind when you're reading, you know, the New York Times or the Washington Post, or listening to NPR or the CBC or the BBC.
And just bring this back to Gaza. This back to Gaza. All the gray check marks. I think some of you will know what I mean by the gray check marks. That's the verification badge that government officials get on Twitter X. All the gray check marks calling for intervention, saying we have to help the Iranian people. Yeah. We have to put more sanctions on Iran. We have to do military. None of those gray check marks are saying we have to do something for Gaza. They never said that.
No,
they never said that. So our friend and colleague Asim Nabi, who you mentioned in the news report, Nora, he had a post yesterday on Twitter where he said this. He said, "Do they think we're stupid? Do they think we in Gaza don't see this? Do you think we don't see you all pretending to care about human rights while you leave us here starving, dying of cold, being bombed?" And I think even the public in the West gets it now.
Yeah. Well, with that, John, you have a special resistance report for today. Ali, do the honors.
I think this is going to be an interesting one today. Yeah. So take it away, John.
Thanks. All right. So you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada. I am John Elmer. This is the Resistance Report for day 832 of Israel's genocidal war. Today, we are going to go back in time a bit. We're going to go back to the early days of the first Battle of Khan Yunis around the end of December 2023, the beginning of January 2024. The ceasefire and prisoner exchange had ended, and Israel didn't want to continue the ceasefire and prisoner exchange because they didn't want that to somehow curtail their genocidal frenzy in Gaza. So they reneged on the extension of the ceasefire in November, and the ground war resumed immediately in northern Gaza and Gaza City, and expanded to Khan Yunis in the south several weeks later. I'm going to show a combat video published by the Qassam Brigades in early January 2024, showing a series of operations in Khan Yunis. The fighters are, of course, blurred as they were throughout the war, and we are watching the battle scenes through the basically through the eyes of the fighters, the cameras on their heads. That's their point of view of the fighters themselves. The operations are, of course, as followers of this program know, deeply complex, but they are shown, especially early in the war, as a tightly edited sequence of operations. This was a common way that Qassam presented their operations. So let's go to that January 2024 video now. And this is how these videos start. We have seen various different ones, especially later in the war. We saw the more of the complex detail in the operations, but early in the battle, this is how the first videos were released. And this was the first one from Khan Yunis, and it's an iconic series of operations. We just saw there a fighter emerging from a tunnel to hit a tank that's basically within spitting distance of the Qassam tunnel. Now we're watching a series of Yassin strikes versus armored vehicles, and it's just one after another, one event after another. Again, we don't see the fighters, you see their hands, because you're essentially looking at it as if you're their cameras are on their foreheads, so you're seeing it really right through their eyes. There's another tunnel operation against a Puma engineering vehicle. This one here, if you watch down in the bottom right corner, you're going to see the fighters sneak up there and attach a guerrilla action device underneath the turret of that Israeli tank in Khan Yunis. And the tank explodes. Around that time, the Israelis acknowledged a number of deaths in an incident similar to that. Unclear if it was exactly that one, but a guerrilla action device placed in the turret, and that is a Yassin strike on a Puma engineering vehicle that's carrying a demining rocket launcher set. And here's the captured equipment from the Israeli soldiers. So again, not a lot of detail, one after another, tight edit, and that is what we came used to know. That's what we know of those operations at the time. This was a single video published by Qassam, and often on the resistance report, I parsed out these videos in individual operations so that we could break down as it as each individual operation rather than the way Qassam presented them one after another. But we know now that this was the Western Battalion of the Khan Yunis Brigade, because this week the Qassam Brigades for the first time began recognizing the names of their soldiers that were killed in the Battle of Al-Aqsa Flood. Their policy during the war was not naming their fighters officially, out of operational security, but also out of safety for their families, something that I think in retrospect seems perfectly reasonable considering the massacre of civilians that defined Israel's what they called the Iron Swords operation. There was two exceptions to this. The Qassam Brigades acknowledged the commander of the middle camps, Ayman Nofal, was killed, and the northern division commander, Ahmed Gandour, were killed early in the war, and Qassam acknowledged both of them, but no fighters were acknowledged. And so what we're seeing, what we're going to see on the show today, is the first look at the first soldiers, and the first time that we have seen the faces of the fighters that are behind the videos that we are watching right now. And the first soldier that they acknowledged was Albara Abdul Karim Abu Hatab. And we can go now to the picture of him, number two. And this is how they've been releasing them. It's called the Moons of the Flood. And this is one of the first of six fighters that they introduced. Albara Abdul Karim Abu Hatab was a squad leader in the Qassam Brigade's Western Battalion in the Khan Yunis Brigade. And it has been revealed here for the first time that the name of the Western Battalion is the Hudayfa ibn al-Yaman Battalion, which is another nod to the Battle of Uhud and the mountain of archers that have been weaved through Qassam's messaging for these past 2 years. Hudayfa ibn al-Yamam was a companion of the Prophet who remained on the Mount of Archers and did not retreat, and was a soldier and a commander throughout many key battles in early Islam, and also known for his operational security and secrecy. So again, Really strong messaging by the Qassam Brigades in the few ways that they have to do it. Al-Bahr Abu Hatib, it says here, was born January 1991 and died in battle in February 2024, which is about midway through the first battle of Khan Yunis that ran from late December to early April. People may remember it ended in Khan Yunis. The first battle of Khan Yunis ended with the Night of Power during Ramadan, a detailed operation that drove Israeli soldiers from Khan Yunis the first time. And Abu Hatib was 33 years old when he was killed. His final testament was one of the first of the six that were released by the Qassam Brigades this week under the banner of the Moons of the Flood, as in the Battle of Al-Aqsa Flood. The testaments are recorded before the battle, and this is a standard thing for resistance fighters to do, for operatives as well. Sometimes they take simple photographs. For example, during the Second Intifada, these martyr posters were the centerpiece of the wall coverings all over the West Bank and Gaza. But sometimes the fighters record longer messages, as is the case in the Moons of the Flood series. So let's watch Abu Hatab's testament and that martyr video that was published just this week, number three. And the video has a music soundtrack to it that I have left out so that I can describe what is going on. But the music is a resistance song saluting the martyrs, describing their place in the national project and on the road to Al-Quds, which you can see there on the screen. And that is the look at Al-Bahr Abu Hatib that we just broke down. This says he's a squad commander, so in charge of a group of somewhere between 7 and 14 fighters. And they've shown him for the first time here. They're showing him in photos here, addressing his troops. In training here, we can see him training with his troops. And this is something that we have seen. It's common for martyrs to have videos like this. During the war, operational secrecy prevailed, but after the war, they salute their martyrs. And that is him there giving his testament. And his testament is deeply thought out. It's poetic. He weaves the scripture through a poetic prose. But he's addressing in his testament, which is playing in the background of the footage that you're seeing him here addressing his troops. He addresses two people principally. First, his people, the Palestinians, who have suffered throughout this war and for decades before. And he says that your blood is precious. Your cries of pain and suffering is foremost in the fighter's consciousness. As other fighters have said, the people are the jewels in the crown of the nation, and they remain steadfast and patient, he said, he says, because the dawn of victory will emerge. He then addresses his fellow fighters, calling them knights, and he said, who stood tall with unceasing determination and unwavering resolve that displays your dignity and which does not and will not disappear or set like the sun. Persist in your quest, even if the goal seems distant. And he repeats that the emerging of the dawn of victory is near. You can see him there on the footage on the screen there addressing his troops. And here we see battle footage. Here we see him in battle. Normally, when the Qassam videos came out, this would be blurred. We would just see their hands. But for Al-Bahr, we see all the detail here of him wiring up a television anti-personnel IED and concealing it here. Usually we would see this in their videos, at least briefly, but we see it here in long form, which is something that we haven't seen before. As he's wiring up these IEDs, he's talking about how the prisoners will be freed and that the usurping enemy will be returned to Gaza in boxes. We see him here now in a tunnel, and he's addressing his squad. He says, praise be to God who made us fighters and guardians of this land. You can see over his shoulder there, the Yassin 105 and his fighters with their blurred faces. Potentially they will... they have survived. And that's one of the reasons why the blurring continues. He says that he tells the fighters, in effect, that your brothers before you have fulfilled their promise and remained steadfast. And now this is our duty too. And he comes up here. You see him through the tunnel on the way to this operation that we saw at the beginning of this segment. You can see him here, and he says that today is the day of revenge, and it is victory or martyrdom, as he moves up the tunnel and out onto the battlefield. You can see them here. This is a battle by a greenhouse against Israeli troops. We saw this footage, and I tracked this footage down, and we'll show it to you after. But there you see the archer who launched from the tunnel at those two Israeli vehicles was Al-Bara. He is the man behind the videos in both of those. So these are sort of missing pieces in the puzzle that we have been putting together of this battle. And it obviously provides a much deeper insight into the fighters that took part, who had been anonymous to us up until this point. Of course, that is part of the resistance strategy, and you can see it prominently displayed in Abu Obeida. It's the opposite of a cult of personality, but the each individual representing the nation in the battle. So we're going to go watch those videos again, but we're going to watch them with the audio in. So I just want to warn people that you're going to hear gunshots and explosions in these next two videos, but I think that the authenticity of the audio track on this is necessary to play. So we're going to do that. Let's start with number four. These are the two tunnel operations.
يلا الشيخ صالح رحمة الله عليه
يلا جاهز جاهز جاهز
So that voice that you heard was Al-Bara, and you can hear him saluting Salah Aruri. He salutes Sheikh Salah. This operation took place in Western Khan Yunis just a few days after the assassination of Salah Aruri in Beirut. And so that's Al-Bara himself. That's the voice that we heard. And it's his voice saluting Sheikh Salah for that operation and saying, God rest, may he rest in peace. And then there's one more. This is the Battle of the Greenhouse that we saw just briefly in his Moons of the Flood video. Let's go to number five here. And again, audio is in. So that greenhouse battle scene was what you briefly saw in Al-Bara's martyr video. And I went back and looked for those operations and tracked them down. And this week's release is just the first of the fallen Palestinian resistance fighters. It's only the beginning. I suspect we'll be getting these for quite some time. And I will continue to follow these and put these pieces together as we did on this show today for Al-Bara Abu Hatab. So this has been the resistance report for day 832 of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
Thank you so much, John. Yeah, putting those pieces together, as someone who appreciates puzzles, and I know you do too. It's like, you know, it's kind of helping to create a tapestry of a history that is important if people want to understand these battles. And and the nature of these indigenous resistance movements. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's just amazing to put names and faces behind the operations that the whole world watched for 2 years.
Yeah.
So we've been waiting for this, for them to acknowledge their fighters. They acknowledge their leaders. And now they're acknowledging their fallen soldiers. So there'll be many more to come, and I'll keep on top of this and see what we find.
Yeah. I mean, there were rumors this week that, you know, Hamas political officials were preparing to start negotiations with the Israelis about phase two through the U.S. mediators, of course. And of course, the sticking point continues to be the Americans and the Israelis' insistence that Hamas, you know, willingly and willfully disarm themselves. There hasn't been, of course, any willingness by the indigenous resistance factions to do so. Has any of that changed from your perspective?
Not on the disarming front, no.
Yeah.
But Hamas did assemble its community support group. It's what do we call them? The technocratic government that was sought. This was an idea that Hamas and Qassam had very early in the war to offer this, and I think in a lot of ways, you know, there's a significant element within. Particularly within the Qassam brigades, that is that doesn't the government isn't the be all and end all for the resistance. In many ways, it's the contrary. So to have this kind of technocratic government is something that the Palestinians have supported, the resistance has supported, and has been now apparently cleared by the Israelis because it had enough Fatah members in it to appease the Israelis.
God.
But we'll see. I mean, there's no negotiations on the second phase. There was just a message from Witkoff saying that, you know, announcing.
Declaring that phase two has started.
Right.
And declaring.
Right.
Yeah. And declaring that, you know, this paves the way for reconstruction and demilitarization. And the point that you've made repeatedly, John, is that Hamas didn't agree to any of this, but they're pretending that Hamas did. And they're pretending this is all proceeding. The other thing that's been reported is that Trump sent out invitations to unnamed persons, they haven't identified who, to join the so-called Board of Peace. So it's hard to see how any of this is more than a fantasy. But
Witkoff's idea, he spoke on his idea. His idea is that there will be a weapons buyback. So that they'll buy back the weapons from the resistance fighters that we just watched. The idea that Al-Bara, for example, would take his guys in the tunnel and say, hey, we're going to get $500 if we turn in our Yassins, and that they'd say, like, yeah, let's do that. But that's where Witkoff, that's how unserious these guys are. And just to say further from Witkoff, to people follow Nora's news off the top of the show, Witkoff said yesterday that aid levels in Gaza were, quote, historic levels of aid.
Yeah.
So that just no.
Yeah. And I Israel mean, has stuck to its obligations under the ceasefire. I mean, it's deranged. It's deranged
colonial
fantasy completely.
And apparently solely in charge. It's just a cult of personality around Jared Kushner and Witkoff.
Yeah. My God.
Dark days.
Dark days. Well, thank you again, John, for that. Asa has a short segment about the hunger strikers in the UK, some of whom have ended their hunger strike. Asa, why don't you give us a rundown of what's been happening in your side of your corner of the world there?
Yeah, that's right, Nora. Well, a reminder that you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. Late yesterday, Wednesday, the 14th of January, prisoners associated with Palestine Action announced the end of their historic hunger strike here in the UK. Kamran Ahmed, Heba Morasi, and Louis Hiaramel, the last three prisoners on hunger strike, announced that... they announced that they were ending their hunger strike in a statement, and they said that they were ending their actions after some of their demands had been met. Several others previously ended their hunger strikes. Morasi, the longest to last out of the hunger strikers, had been going for 73 days, the same number of days as Kieran Doherty, an Irish Republican hunger striker who survived the longest out of the 10 prisoners who died during the 1981 hunger strike led by Bobby Sands, of course. The decision to end the strike came the day after the news that Elbit was being denied a £2 billion contract, that's billion with a B, to train British troops over a decade. The Times of London reported that the Israeli arms firm failed to reach the next stage of the procurement process due to alleged breaking of the rules by former British Army officer Philip Kimber, who the paper said had improperly met with Elbit officials to discuss the lucrative bid. Prisoners for Palestine said in the statement, quote, "While these prisoners end their hunger strike, the resistance has just begun. Banning our group and imprisoning our comrades has backfired on the British state. Direct action is alive, and the people will drive Elbit out of Britain for good," end of quote. They also said that the hunger strikers had won other concessions, including the government ordering prison healthcare officials to meet with their representatives, a lessening of restrictions on mail and book deliveries, the agreement in principle that Heba Morasi would be transferred to another prison closer to her family, and the disclosure by the Department of Trade of the details of Elbit's arms licenses for the last 5 years. Many of the Palestine Action political prisoners face potentially years in prison while awaiting trials, and yet they have not been released on bail. Here's a short clip of Francesca Nadim from Prisoners for Palestine, a former Palestine Action political prisoner herself, from a short speech I filmed at a demonstration outside the High Court in London yesterday.
At night in your house, in bed, to have anti-terror police pointing guns at your head, to imagine what it feels like to be locked up for prison indefinitely without a trial just for doing the right thing, which is to stop weapons being made in this country to go and murder Palestinian people. Imagine what it feels like to be called a terrorist every day in prison. Imagine what it feels like not to eat anything for 72 days, but still be so determined and never waver on that path because you know that it's the right thing to do. I actually saw Heba, one of the hunger strikers, just on Saturday. It's the first time I saw her since the hunger strike started, because the last time I went, they wouldn't actually let me in the prison. It's the same prison that I was in, actually, and she's in the exact same cell that I used to be in. So obviously, because we have our opinions about them, they don't like us very much, and they'll do whatever they can to just treat us in the worst way possible. But still, I managed to get in that day. And despite everything, I was so amazed about how mentally strong she is, how determined she is.
Palestine Action, the direct action protest group which targeted Elbit Systems, was of course banned by Britain's Home Secretary last summer. The decision is currently being appealed through the courts, with an important ruling expected soon. In other Palestine Action legal news, on Tuesday this week, a jury retired to consider its verdict in the first Filton 24 trial. A decision could come any day. Six defendants were accused of breaking into an Israeli-owned arms factory in Filton near Bristol in 2024. It is thought that the High Court judges, considering the government's ban, which defines the group as a so-called terrorist organisation, despite its non-violent nature, will be watching the Filton ruling carefully. And as ever, so will we.
Thank you, Asa. Is there any word yet about the health conditions of some of the former hunger strikers? I mean, you know, that after what, 70 days of it's, it, I mean, we're talking sometimes permanent organ damage or at least failure of certain organ systems. Have they been receiving medical treatment? What do you know about their condition?
Well, the Prisoners for Palestine statement that I referred to there in that report did mention that they've begun refeeding procedures along, you know, the advised guidelines. So it reading between the lines a bit there, it does sound like they're receiving some sort of health care.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll be hearing more in the near future about their, you know, permanent effects on their health, as we saw. Yeah. But, you know, they seem to be in good spirits, at least. I was talking to Francesca at the demonstration yesterday, the lady we saw in that clip there, and she was actually on the phone to Heber at one point.
Wow.
And they seem to be in good spirits together. So that's a positive we can take out of that.
Incredible. It's just so frightening, and that it had to get to that point, that the British state is so committed to protecting Israel and the weapons manufacturing contracts that it has, that it was willing to let these, you know, unarmed protesters almost die in prison.
They really came to the brink. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think all we can do, I mean, I stand in awe at their commitment, the sacrifice they made and that they were willing to make for their beliefs in something that should not be controversial.
Yeah.
It should be commonplace that there should be no genocide. There should be no arms for a country committing genocide, and that they had to go to these lengths. So I just want to, you know, offer my best wishes to them, gratitude to them and their friends and family, and wish them a speedy recovery and, you know, enormous gratitude.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were protesting for their basic rights, you know, and it has to be said that some of their demands have not been met. You know, they were really asking to be released on bail. You know, as I mentioned, you know, that it could be years before some of these people see a courtroom. And meanwhile, they're sitting in jail on remand without being convicted of any crime. And yet, you know, they're being denied the rights that most other people in their situation would be given. So they're absolutely political prisoners. Yeah. It's absolutely a politicized process. And a final word on that. I mean, I think it may not be the last we see of these hunger strikes.
Yeah.
One of the previous hunger strikers is now who ended his hunger strike at a certain point has now started again, and he's around day five.
Wow.
On hunger strike. So we may see there may be another round of this to come yet, of more rolling hunger strikes, you know, as they, the hunger strikers, the prisoners learn from the lessons from this particular wave of their struggle.
Wow. That's incredible. Well, thank you for keeping an eye on that, Asa. Ali, you had an update about another form of strike or protest, this time concerning the Adelaide Writers' Week. But before we get to that, do you want to talk a little bit about some breaking news that we just received about Mahmoud Khalil of Columbia University, of course?
And yes, just in the last hour, of course, people will remember that last year, the Trump administration detained Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University student organizer, a very peaceful organizer, exercising his First Amendment rights. And he spent more than 90 days in a detention facility in horrible conditions while the Trump administration tries to deport him. They're still trying to deport him, even though he was released. Well, unfortunately, there was a severe setback today. A federal appeals court reversed the lower court decision that released Mahmoud Khalil from immigration jail, bringing the government one step closer to detaining and ultimately deporting the Palestinian activists. That's according to the Associated Press. A three-judge panel of the Third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia instructed the lower court to dismiss Khalil's habeas petition, the court filing that secured his release. There are some legal technicalities about this, but that's the bottom line. The Center for Constitutional Rights, which has been representing Mahmoud Khalil in court and in this proceeding, issued a press release, and they say the opinion does not go into effect immediately, and the Trump administration cannot lawfully re-detain Mr. Khalil until the order takes formal effect, which will not happen while he has the opportunity to seek immediate review. Mr. Khalil's legal team has several legal avenues they may pursue, including seeking review en banc from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which would allow all judges from the Third Circuit to weigh in. Mahmoud Khalil himself said, "Today's ruling is deeply disappointing, but it does not break our resolve. The door may have been opened for potential re-detainment down the line, but it has not closed our commitment to Palestine and to justice and accountability. I will continue to fight through every legal avenue and with every ounce of determination until my rights and the rights of others like me are fully protected." And this is just a terrible reminder that it is people protesting against genocide who are being put in the prisons, whether it's in the UK, whether it's in the United States, and not the perpetrators of the genocide. It is sick and perverse. And so all solidarity with Mahmoud Khalil. It's an appalling decision. And of course, I'm sure we all hope that his lawyers will be able to fight back and challenge this ruling.
Absolutely. Thank you for that update, Ali. Let's talk a little bit about another story you've been focused on, the Adelaide Writers' Week in Australia. Take us through what happened and why it's significant.
Yeah, and so just a reminder that you're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. The 2026 Adelaide Writers' Week, one of Australia's most prominent literary festivals, has been cancelled after a fierce backlash over the removal of Palestinian-Australian author Randa Abdel Fattah from its program. Abdel Fattah had been scheduled to speak at the event, which was set to take place from late February to early March. But on the 8th of January, the Adelaide Festival Board rescinded her invitation, claiming her presence might not be, quote, culturally sensitive in the wake of the December 2025 Bondi Beach attack, even while insisting her work bore no link to the violence. The decision was widely condemned as discriminatory and an act of censorship, especially given Abdel Fattah's long history of advocacy for Palestinian rights and her critique of Israeli policy. Many authors saw her exclusion as an attempt to silence critical voices and to capitulate to political pressure rather than to uphold principles of free expression. Within days, a mass boycott erupted. More than 180 authors and speakers, including local and international figures, withdrew from the festival in solidarity with Abdel Fattah, and several board members resigned, including Adelaide Writers' Week director Louise Adler, who said she could not be party to silencing writers. Among the prominent figures who withdrew are acclaimed British novelist Zadie Smith, former New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, former Greek finance minister and left-wing politician Yanis Varoufakis, and Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen. With its lineup completely dismantled and its leadership in disarray, the festival organizers announced that the 2026 Adelaide Writers' Week could no longer proceed as planned and was formally cancelled. A newly constituted Adelaide Festival Board has acknowledged the decision to remove Abdel Fattah from the program was wrong. It has issued an unreserved apology and invited her to participate in next year's event. Let's listen to Randa Abdel Fattah reacting to that apology.
This apology as acknowledgement of our right to speak publicly and truthfully about the atrocities that have been committed against the Palestinian people. I accept this apology as a vindication of our collective solidarity and mobilisation against censorship. I accept this unreserved apology as acknowledgement of the harm inflicted on our communities. I will consider the board's invitation to participate in 2027 Adelaide Writers Week at the appropriate time, but would be there in a heartbeat if Louise Adler was the director again. Whilst the Adelaide Festival statement acknowledges the harm done, it is not a quick fix to repair the damage and injury inflicted. This episode highlights three urgent matters: the profound lack of racial literacy in our public institutions and the need for urgent anti-racism education that is informed by Indigenous perspectives and frameworks; the need for public institutions to have safeguards against political interference by lobbyists; and the imperative of accountability for those who shirk their governance duties in a failure to understand that their duty of care is to their stakeholders and to the community, not groups acting in the interests of external political players. Thank you, everybody, for your support and your unwavering solidarity. We did this together.
I think that this marks a major cultural and political turning point. Israel lobby groups and mainstream politicians sought to exploit and weaponize the horrific Bondi Beach attack to further limit public space for Palestinians and Palestine solidarity, but it spectacularly backfired. And the result of their efforts is a reaffirmation of the right of Palestinians to speak, to be included, and to have a voice. So I thought it was really important to highlight that.
Absolutely. And I can't think of another, you know, very high profile writers or cultural conference of this, you know, of this magnitude to that would in recent years have ever been canceled because of all the, you know, solidarity of its participants. This is an incredible action of collective solidarity from people who, you know, I don't know if Zadie Smith has ever done anything in support of Palestine before at this high a level. And someone like her and all of these other authors taking this action is incredibly significant. And I hope it puts other cultural institutions and, you know, these elite, you know, writers' conferences on notice if they are still trying in 2026 after two you know, ongoing years of a genocide to silence Palestinians or lump them in as you know, as they've been dehumanized to be. So this is incredible. Ali, there's also some news that you reported for us just yesterday about Beitar, the Zionist terror group in New York. Tell us about what happened there, why it's significant as well.
Yeah, this is a quite another unprecedented event in a way. On Tuesday, that was January 13th, New York's Attorney General released the results of a civil rights investigation into the extremist Zionist group Beitar, People will recall that this group was taking credit for getting people like Mahmoud Khalil, who we just talked about, arrested and deported by compiling dossiers and sending them to the Trump administration and harassing activists in the street. And according to the Attorney General, Bettar waged a sustained campaign of violence, intimidation, and harassment targeting Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and Jewish activists, tactics that violated New York civil rights law. After the state civil rights investigation laid bare Bettar's extremism, including urging members to, quote, get Jews armed and, quote, to attend and disrupt Palestine solidarity actions, including bringing weapons to protests, the group agreed to a settlement requiring it to cease and desist from its campaign of violence and incitement. As part of the deal, Bettar faces a suspended $50,000 fine if it violates the agreement, and it has claimed or indicated that it is winding down its New York operations. But for many Palestinian rights supporters, including Nerdin Kiswani, who has been one of their most prominent targets, the settlement represents a symbolic step, leaving broader questions about accountability and the ongoing threat of organized Zionist violence and harassment unresolved. So, but it is unprecedented for a state government in the United States to carry out such a civil rights investigation and to take any action against a Zionist group like this in order to protect Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, and Jewish activists who have been part of the solidarity movement. So in that sense, it is quite unprecedented.
Yeah. And I mean, the questions that people have been asking, and you asked this in your article that we published, is, you know, I mean, in the settlement, it says that there is a, you know, $50,000 fine for any violations in the future, but it doesn't look like there's any consequences for the reign of terror that this group has carried out in the last, specifically in the last few years around New York. What can you say about, you know, accountability for the crimes that Bettar has been involved in?
Yeah, this is a really important question, and people have been looking at this. First, I mean, let me just give you some examples of what the Attorney General's report's factual findings were. It says that, as I mentioned, Bettar's mission was to get Jews armed and to attend and disrupt Palestine solidarity protests. The group described its own members as, quote, cruel and aggressive, and asserted that, quote, violence is needed. The Attorney General found that Bettar's violence and harassment are motivated by the anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, and anti-Muslim sentiment expressed by its leadership and members. And the Attorney General noted Bettar's really vile and notorious declarations in the midst of the genocide that not enough Palestinian babies had been killed. And at one point, the group declared, "We demand blood in Gaza." Now, as the Attorney General's findings detail, Bettar went beyond these blood-curdling statements. These were actually translated into actual assaults and violence against individuals in New York. The group encouraged members to bring weapons to Palestine solidarity protests. The Attorney General found, including pepper spray, knives, and tactical flashlights that Bettar intended to use to beat activists with. And in one incident cited in the report on 18th of February, 2025, members of Bettar attacked a Palestine solidarity rally in Brooklyn's Borough Park neighborhood, quote, Bataar members attacked protesters and at least one activist was stabbed. So we're talking here about serious crimes. Those are just examples. There are quite a few others detailed in the report. So people are asking, why is Bataar only getting a fine which is suspended? So they don't pay it unless there are future violations. And the reason for that is because this was the Attorney General's office in the state of New York has civil jurisdiction to carry out civil rights violations. And by law, all it can do is impose fines. So in a sense, the Attorney General's office did pretty much all it can do under the law. It is up to other entities, for example, the New York Police Department, the local district attorneys, to bring criminal charges for the types of violent assaults that are contained in the report. So the question is, has that happened? And I actually tried to investigate that. So I did send inquiries to the New York Police Department, the NYPD, and got no response. I did talk to someone at the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office, and that was very interesting because the person I spoke to told me, first of all, I said, you know, in normal circumstances, if somebody stabs someone in a street in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn District Attorney would be the body that prosecutes that crime. Yes, the person I spoke to said, yes, that is the case. But they said, and I asked them, are you familiar with the incidents described in the Attorney General's report? And she said, yes, I'm very familiar with them. I said, are you carrying out any prosecutions of these crimes? She said, no, we haven't charged anyone because the feds, meaning the federal government, took this investigation over. What does that mean? Well, it means that the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York assumed jurisdiction, pushing the local prosecutors out. Well, that could mean one of two things. One, that the federal government considers these to be very serious incidents, and therefore they want to prosecute them. The other thing it could mean is that the federal government took these cases from the local district attorney because they essentially want to bury them. And, well, what's the political reality we're in? The Trump administration is asserting direct political control over U.S. attorneys' offices, over federal prosecutors, including Southern District of New York. And so we don't know. I tried to contact the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. I was not able to get anywhere. But if I had to bet, I want to be surprised. I want to be wrong. But I bet that that's where those cases went to die. And we won't see prosecutions of Bataar members for these crimes. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep demanding them. Doesn't mean that the victims of these crimes don't have the right to justice. But you can see why they would be frustrated by that.
I mean... And it's not like Bataar has closed its operations, at least online. They're still out there harassing people, people like, as you mentioned, Nurdin Kiswani of Within Our Lifetime in New York City. They've been very personal with their terror and harassment against her and her child.
They've terrorized her and others. You know, I spoke to, Nurdin Kiswani is quoted in my article, and I actually spoke to her yesterday, and she spoke about really the terrorizing effect and that this had on her life. And she's only one of many who have been terrorized by this group, of course, and that includes students and others who have faced detention or deportation proceedings. Possibly because of Bataar's collusion with the Trump administration. So this is I think the quote from Janine Yunis, who is one of their victims, and she's also the legal director for ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, really sums it up. She said, this is a good start, but it's not enough. Bettar is of course, she's referring to the Attorney General's action, but she says Bettar is a terrorist hate organization. It openly endorses and threatens violence against Palestinians and Muslims, including me, and those who advocate for Palestinian rights. They should have their tax-exempt status revoked, and individual members should be investigated for crimes. Well, today on their Twitter X account, Bettar was soliciting for tax-deductible charitable donations.
Yeah.
And, you know, they claim, I mean, it's stated in the press release from the New York Attorney General's office that Bettar indicated that it is going to dissolve its nonprofit corporation that allows it to solicit tax-deductible contributions, essentially to terrorize and commit acts of violence against people. But as far as I can tell, it maintains its tax, its charitable status with the IRS, the U.S. Internal Revenue Service, and is still raising tax-deductible funds. It is still inciting hatred and violence. The day before the settlement agreement was announced, they were posting tweets calling for harm to Ms. Rachel, the children's entertainer who has attracted so much love on the one hand and hatred on the other, for simply saying Palestinian children deserve not to be murdered and maimed, deserve to be loved and cared for like any other children.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't necessarily fault the New York State Attorney General's office because they don't have jurisdiction over all aspects of this, and they don't have global jurisdiction. Bettar claims to be operating out of Israel. It, in fact, claims to be operating out of the same building as the Likud party headquarters, the ruling party of Israel, and it claims to have many members of the Israeli government in its ranks. So in a sense, this organization could be seen as an arm of the Israeli government to terrorize people in the streets of American cities. Yeah. And therefore, you know, this the same federal government that is arresting students and deporting them for writing op-eds in the student newspaper calling for international law to be respected should be the one cracking down on this terror, but they're actually apparently in cahoots with it.
Yeah, this is the point I wanted to make early. Like, if you've, I mean, I know you've seen it, but if our viewers have seen the documentary that the Grey Zone did on Bettar, where one of their they had an undercover reporter who essentially sort of infiltrated Bettar and got some very candid behind the scenes footage, you could see how extreme and unhinged they are. So it's tempting to think of them as sort of outliers and sort of crazy people. And they are in a way, but also, you know, Israel uses these kinds of groups, you know, especially in the last 10 to 15 years. You know, there's some very nasty organizations internationally that Israel uses and instrumentalizes and coordinates with, including you know, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, as was, and there are some very sort of I don't know, sort of headbangerish organizations in Britain, for example. Like there's a group called Sussex Friends of Israel, which at a certain point was known for harassing activists on the street in Brighton, and so forth. And yet they get invited to these symposiums and conferences in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem for official Israeli government functions, presumably, you know, getting paid to do so, or at least their expenses paid for those conferences. And so, you know, these organizations like Bettar do have these, like you said, Ali, I saw the same declarations that Bettar made after, you know, the announcement of the suspension of their operation in New York. You know, claiming all these legitimizations from the Israeli state itself, and from Netanyahu, and these connections are absolutely there. Secondly, in relation to that, we got a tip from a viewer in the chat saying that it's kind of a historical trivia, but I think it is related to this. Vladimir Jabotinsky himself, when he died in 1940, Vladimir Jabotinsky being the founder of right-wing so-called revisionist Zionism, he died in New York in 1940, was actually visiting a Batar training camp. Now, this would be the original Batar organization, and this new organization now is a new organization, but they claim descendants of the same original Batar, which is the youth wing, essentially, of the right wing revisionist Zionists, who were, you know, who are the political antecedents of Netanyahu and the Likud party and the terrorist Zionist organizations who in Palestine at the time.
So, and they are and were fascist in the literal sense. The original Betar, which this organization, you know, claims, as you say, to be a continuation of, actually had an alliance with Mussolini, the Italian fascist leader, and Mussolini invited them to Italy, and they set up a military training academy, the so-called Betar Naval Academy in Italy, which operated in Civitavecchia in near the coast, near Rome, in the 1930s. So these were literal fascists modeled on the fascist movements of 1930s Europe that, of course, were ultimately responsible for, what we're told is the greatest evil of all time, the Holocaust. They were aligned with the movements that did that.
Yep.
Absolutely, and we've actually got that the tip. I checked the tip from that reader, and it checks out. So we actually have a headline from 1940: Vladimir Jabotinsky dies of heart attack at 59. Was visiting youth camp. A bit further down, it says death occurred a few hours after Jabotinsky had reviewed a parade of the campers, members of the Zionist revisionist youth organization known as Brith Trumbledore, which shortened is Betar.
Betar, actually, it's sort of a, we're getting into the weeds here, but it's a double meaning. So it is that acronym for Brit Trumbledore, but Betar is also the sort of Hebraicized name of my own family's village, Batir, was the site of the so-called Bar Kokhba revolution. And so it has that double meaning. And then, of course, we have the same. It also continues in the name of the Israeli football club, Betar Yerushalayim, which is also notorious for its fascist violence and anti-Arab racism. A few years ago, we reported on how the fans of that club, who interestingly are called La Familia, which is an Italian-sounding term. I wonder if that goes back to the Mussolini connection. Mm-hmm. But the members of La Familia were in uproar and rioted when Betar had two Muslim players who were not Palestinian or Arab. I think, you know, they were from somewhere. I can't remember all the details, but I think they were Chechen or something like that.
Yeah.
They rioted because they're just so utterly fascist and racist.
And it's like you said, Ali, that I think the main point here is that this wing of Zionism has always been explicitly and proudly fascist. Like the Jabotinsky's armed wing, you could say, the Irgun, there was one splinter group of that, called, you know, they had an internal dispute and fell out with each other, called the Lichai. And the Lichai explicitly sent negotiation efforts towards Adolf Hitler himself. And they wanted to, you know, these were explicitly fascist organizations who, you know, were involved in the founding of the Israeli state and the Israeli military itself. So, you know, these connections go back a long way.
Thank you for that. Just absolutely despicable. Ali, I know you're going to keep your your keen eye on all of the legal and judicial machinations, at least the ones in New York around Beitar. So thank you for that. Finally, you have a legal update of your own. Tell us about the charges that you and your legal team have filed against someone in Europe.
Yes, things are moving quickly. Last week, I reported how the administrative court in the canton of Zurich ruled that my detention last year in Switzerland, my arrest and detention, was unconstitutional and violated the European Convention on Human Rights. And of course, I was detained to stop me from speaking at public events in Zurich about the genocide in Gaza. And then I was taken to the airport in handcuffs from the prison in a cage and deported. So a blatant political attack on free speech. And so on January 12th, I filed a criminal complaint with the public prosecutor of the Canton of Zurich against Nicoletta Della Valle, the former director of Fedpol, Switzerland's national police agency. The complaint alleges abuse of official office related to my illegal arrest and detention. And the reason why I've filed criminal charges against her is because, as we've reported previously, ASA did a great article on this in November. A Swiss parliamentary investigation found that Nicoletta Della Valle had personally intervened to basically ensure I got arrested after Fedpol had rejected a request for me to be banned from entering Switzerland and had ruled that my opinions are protected by freedom of expression, which is a constitutional right in Switzerland, and also that I represented no threat to the security of Switzerland. She overruled that in a procedure that the parliamentary committee said was improper, irregular, and they said that there was evidence of political interference. And of course, what is absolutely fascinating about Nicoletta Della Valle is that she retired just days after my arrest and very quickly took a job with Champel Capital. This is an Israeli investment firm that invests primarily in the weapons industry, so it directly profits off genocide. And its founder is Amir Weitman. He is a activist with Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. He's been an outspoken supporter of Israel's genocide, and he advocates for the entire Palestinian population, Gaza, to be ethnically cleansed to Egypt. And Champel Capital's senior partners include retired Israeli general Giora Eiland, one of the authors of the so-called General's Plan to starve and ethnically cleanse the population in Gaza. So this is the person who effectively ordered my arrest, effectively ordered these illegal and unconstitutional measures, and I want to bring her to justice. I have the opportunity to do so, and I want this to be a deterrent, and I want to show that we can and should fight back wherever we can. I've never filed criminal charges like this before. I have said that I have filed other criminal charges related to these events that I'll talk about in the future. So I don't know exactly how this process will play out, but I have very good, very tough, very determined lawyers in Switzerland, and we're going to fight for accountability and transparency because, like others who face the situation, I think we have to show that there is a cost, there is a price to violating our basic rights and trying to silence us during a genocide.
Excellent. Is there anything else? What's the timeline here? Is there, what's the next step?
Well, what I can say is that in other cases where we filed criminal charges, less than a year ago, remember this happened in January, and I think we might have filed those criminal charges. I don't remember exactly, but a few months later, the state prosecutor is now moving forward on those cases. So it's, you know, we know that the wheels of justice aren't particularly quick, but I've got time.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ali. And with that, let's take a look at the Electronic Intifada website. There's Ali's post about Beitar and the decision in New York. If you want to read up on that, it's right at the top there. We have a bunch of new features. As I mentioned in the news report, I read a little excerpt of Khaled El-Hissi's feature. There's so much more to that story, so please go find that. Fate of Gaza's Disappeared Remains Unknown by Khaled. We also have some extraordinary features that I haven't had a chance to read. They're just published. Ali, what have, and of course the Palestinian Pictures photo essay and roundup of the month's events that our colleague and our senior editor, Maureen Claire Murphy, puts together every month. Just an incredible collection of images and moments from December 2025, with a very well researched and sourced, as always, essay about the news. Ali, what have you been reading from EI in the past few days?
Well, I try to, like everyone else, I try to keep up with the reading. I always try to read a few times a week the pieces from our writers in Gaza. The piece by Khaled El-Hissi that you shared some of in the news report is one that really stuck with me this week, because, you know, I know people personally in Gaza who do not know the fate of their loved ones. They don't know if they're dead or alive. Mothers who don't know where their sons are. People don't know where their brothers are, their husbands are. And it is almost a greater agony than knowing they're dead and having that closure and being able to mourn them. And so that piece really struck me. And
that piece that's on there, The Freedom is the Eternal Dream, that's interviews with released prisoners in Egypt by Rueda Amer. It's an excellent story and has Mahmoud Al-Arda, who was part of the Battle of the Jenin camp, and he was part of the Freedom Tunnel, the fellas that dug out of Megiddo. Gilboa prison.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And
in 2020. Yeah,
they didn't know they were being deported until,
And that's another extraordinary piece. And the piece by Nadira Mushtaha about the universities in Gaza picking up and trying to get back to some kind of, I don't think you can say business as usual given the destruction, but the absolute determination of people in Gaza to have education, to have life, to persist and remain on their land, and to build themselves through education is just extraordinary. And people did not stop studying throughout the genocide. No. People were graduating.
Yeah.
Professors were teaching and grading papers throughout this genocide. Yeah.
People were defending their PhD dissertations.
So you think that if they're going to do it at the height of the genocide, they're not going to do it now, then you'd be mistaken, because they're doing it. So that piece really also struck me.
Well, as always, go to electronicintifada.net to read all of our new features, reports, news posts, and analyses. Ali, we have some people we wanted to thank this week who have been supporting the work that we do at EI. Who's on the list this week?
Everyone's on the list. We are so blessed to have so many people around the world who here watching this live stream, who watch the segments, who read and share the articles, who send us lovely notes, who, you know, keep us all going. I think we all keep each other going. And that's something I hear time and again. We get the most touching messages from people saying things like that, you know, I wouldn't have been able to get through these past couple of years without you guys, without you being here every week, providing a place where I can feel that I'm among people who understand how I feel and what I'm going through, who give me the sort of motivation to keep going out and raising my voice, taking part in actions. And so I want to thank all of you for that. It's just extraordinary, and it never, never gets old. Every time I hear that, I'm just so deeply touched and grateful for everyone who supports us. And of course, for everyone who makes the work possible through your gifts and donations, which I stress, you should only ever give us if you have a bit of extra money. We don't want anyone. There's enough people who have the resources to make this work. And for everyone else, this is for you. We are making this for everyone in the world. So with that, just a very few people I'm going to name, with love to those I can't name. Salim, Michal, Adelmo, Gregory, Joanna, Douglas, Emily, Dieter, Marco, Jana, Ivan, Chris, Stefan, and Ayo. Thanks to you and to everyone else for keeping us going and keeping us strong.
And also thanks to Tanya, who's a friend, and we wanted to give her a special shout out as well. And of course, you can always go to electronicintifada.net, hit the Donate Now link. You can be a monthly donor to help support this platform of information and analysis, and our cadre of courageous contributors in Gaza. We are so proud to work with all of our contributors, especially in these circumstances that just keep getting worse. I want to personally thank Tamara Nassar, of course, our producer and director extraordinaire. Thank you, Tamara. Thank you to Ellie Gerzon for social media production. Thanks to Pierre Loisel for radio production. Thank you to Maureen Claire Murphy and Michael F. Brown and all of our colleagues at the Electronic Intifada, of course. And on behalf of myself and Ali, John, Asa, and Tamara, thank you all, and we will see you next week. From